Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have as my guest, I have Steve Kenny, who is the owner of SRK Pool Services. Hi, Steve. How are you today?
I'm doing well, John. Thank you. How are you?
Great. I'm so happy you're back on the show again. One of the things I wanted to talk about, obviously, is talking about the purity of water in pools. And a lot of people think that having chlorine in a pool is a good thing. And what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree. I think a certain amount of chlorine is a healthy thing to have. I think you need to have a trace amount of chlorine that's free and available to fight bacteria, as we spoke about last time. I don't feel that if you can smell chlorine, then that's when you know there's something wrong with the chlorine, because elemental chlorine that we talked about has an odor. It's odorless and tasteless to bonds to ammonia. So when it's tied up and you smell it, that means that something's wrong.
So it's broken down? Is that what happens?
No, it's actually bonded with ammonia, and it's just tied up. It's busy playing with ammonia, so it's giving off that gas smell, and that's where it's releasing that gas. And that's the harmful part. If you watch somebody swimming and their mouths, you know, they come up for air, and they're inhaling all that because they're perspiring in the water, and that perspiration is bonding with chlorine, causing the chloramines. So you have to find a way to break that bond between ammonia and chlorine on a continuous basis so that it's free and available to fight bacteria.
Right.
And there's no protocol for that. And there's no protocol in the health department. There's no protocol for commercial pools. And that's something that...
Yeah, but you're on a crusade, so to speak, to change that.
Well, we built that trailer for that reason. I don't know if you... Are you familiar with the trailer?
No, I'm not. Tell me about that.
Oh, I built a trailer to help show people. So I built the Maidstone Club system on a trailer. It runs on a diesel generator. I can treat up to 250,000 gallons. It'll take me 12 hours to show you and your board members exactly how I can clear up the water, clear up the air.
Wow, that is great.
It's pretty wild. Yeah.
So a lot of people think, to eliminate chlorine, let's go with a saltwater pool. And it's not the salt water that we think is from the ocean.
No, it's not. No, right. It's salt. And you're adding salt to the pool, and you're basically creating a little battery in there because you're sending electrolysis into the water. The electricity with a nickel-plated ion, it charges the particles of salt into sodium hypochlorite, so you still have chlorine in the pool. But that only gives you the 10% of chlorine you need. But where's the other 90% of oxidation coming from? You follow? So
it's not what it's cranked up to be?
No, they sold it as a chlorine-free solution 15, 20 years ago, which is the wrong thing. So they misled the public. You know, the public doesn't trust anybody, and now we have to be held accountable for our actions when dealing with water. And that's something that has to happen.
Well, you know, it's a lot of people have pools on the, by the water. So that's one of the concerns that if something did happen to the pool, leaked it somehow or another, that this chlorine would leach into the to the bays or into the ocean. And you're saying even if it's a saltwater pool, that's still...
Well, I think salt's pretty bad too. I mean, you think about they've outlawed salt water pools in California and Santa Clara or Santa, I don't remember the name of the town, but it's outlawed because it's destroying their fish because they're dumping it into their reservoirs. So if you took 100, 300, 800 pounds of salt and poured it on your lawn, what's going to happen to the grass?
It's going to die.
Right. So if I poured my water on your grass, it'd probably grow greener.
Well, you came up with a system called the Hydro Zone 3 system, correct?
Correct, yes.
So what is that?
Well, when I finally understood that water has the ability to corrode and scale and that it's based upon this logarithm that this guy Langular put together, the calcium, the pH, the alkalinity, the water temperature, and there's a factor of 12.1.
Well, that's another question. Langlier saturation index.
Yeah.
So you'll get into that.
It plays
that.
Into that. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's important to have that. And when I was working with that index, I found that every time I'd add a certain oxidizer, it had an action and equal reaction to the index, and it would make the water scale and corrode. So I was battling with that for 15 years. And then I finally came with this idea that, you know what? If I can use an oxidizer that has a negative impact on that index and then a sanitizer that had a negative impact on that index, then I don't have water corroding and scaling. I can maintain that perfect water equilibrium of not scaling for bather comfort. And I don't have to carry chlorine around and shock around and tablets around. I just, let the machines do it.
Right. Now, are you one of the only pool services out here that's into this system, or not the system, but I mean what you're talking about?
Because
my thinking is that a lot of these pool companies just test to see if the chlorine is and the pH is in balance.
Well, in fairness to them, it's hard because our industry has been left to do whatever it wants to do. And no one's been regulating us. Just lately, the Center Disease Control came out with the Model Aquatic Health Code in August, which is passed out to all the states with recommendations on how to treat water and how to keep water safe and also all the other requirements. So you're going to see a big shift in... You have to be educated and licensed to touch water. Because
so it's not just saying, okay, the pH is this number, so I have to get up the pH, add some.
I mean, you have a certain social responsibility to keep that water perfect. And when I look at it, I'm more concerned about it, these kids. And I see these kids swimming in this, and their hair smells, their eyes are burning, their ear infections. And
that's all from the too much chlorine.
Well, it's from not understanding water chemistry. It goes down to understanding the whole pool as a whole, how it moves, the velocities, the turnover rates.
Right. Now, you have something that's interesting, too, is you have a remote maintenance.
I do remote monitoring.
Thank you.
In the Bahamas and also in Avalon, New Jersey and Philadelphia. There's no need for me to be there. I don't need to suck the dirt out of them. You really just want me there to be the, like Apple has AppleCare for Macintosh. We're the same way. So we look over their shoulder. We log in every morning. I check for problems. If I see an issue, I'll have the people on site and I train them. On site and also train them through remote monitoring, I'll tell them what to do.
Right.
And this way I can prevent the homeowner from complaining. And if I get in that service, I mean, that's what I learned from the culinary is, it's all about, dotting your I's, crossing your T's and making it a wonderful experience.
Right. Somebody once said that your water is delicious, and that was a compliment, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah,
and that's because of your background in the restaurant
business. Well, it's because I'm doing it right and I have a passion for doing things right.
Right. Well, that's good.
Exciting. Yeah.
So with your system, is it less maintenance then? Is that what you're saying?
In the long run, yeah. Well, not even in the long run, right off the bat, the Maidstone Club found that there was nothing to do. They never got closed. They had no issues. The bather load went up 80%. The usage went up and no complaints. So they're actually able to focus on other things instead of putting out fires every 20 minutes with somebody complaining about the water.
A lot of people go for a gunite pool as compared to a vinyl pool. Do you think there's any advantage to that except the price?
Well, I'm a big fan of the substrate has to be as hard as possible. Tile is 0% absorption rate, which means it's hard for pathogens or anything to grow in it or germs. So I like to have a really hard, hard surface. The denser the surface, the better. I can't apply that to a vinyl pool, unfortunately. So I would prefer to use a gunite pool where I can put a harder structure.
Interesting.
And, and that's what we talk about. It's about the runoffs. It's about how fast I can take that top half inch of water. That's the most contaminated layers, that top half inch. I need to take it off.
Is that because of the heat from the sun?
No. If you look in a pool and you look inside a skimmer, you see that scum line in there or all the way around the pool. Well, that's a lot of surface area that you have to clear off. And a lot of the commercial pools have gutter systems for that reason, because you want to remove that top half inch as fast as possible and treat it.
Interesting.
So that's the way we design them.
Steve, you must have a website that people can go to, right?
Yes, we do. Yeah.
Okay. And that's called?
SRKpools.com.
Oh, that's easy. SRKpools.com. Okay. Yes. Well, Steve, it's been a pleasure having you on the program again.
Thank you, John.
This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back with our next guest, Executive Director of the Bay Street Theater, Tracy Mitchell. Hi, this is John Christopher for Real Life, and today I have as my guest Tracy Mitchell, who is the Executive Director of Bay Street Theater. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, John. I'm well. Thank you.
You look well, too. So, Tracy, tell us about your journey to becoming the Executive Director of Bay Street Theater. Did you know you wanted to be involved in the theater at an early age?
I actually did. I've been in entertainment, actually, my whole life. I started as a child singer, growing up, traveling around the world singing. And so I knew that I'd be involved in it in some way, shape, or form. And I actually loved musical theater. I was never a good enough actor to make that happen. But I did live in the city for a while and had singing groups. And it was there that I got involved in the television and film business, became a producer, and subsequently moved out here with my husband after 9/11. And I was approached by the then board chairman of Bay Street who knew that how much I loved theater, how much I loved the entertainment business, and they happened to be looking for an executive director at that time.
And you fit the bill.
Yeah, well, her pitch was, you don't need to make any money anymore, do you? Have we got a great job for you?
Something that doesn't
pay well.
The world
of nonprofit.
Right, right. But you'll have fun, right?
Exactly.
So I understand you've been doing this now, what, about 10 years?
10 years. It was my 10-year anniversary.
10 years. There we go. Congratulations.
It only feels like 20. Just kidding.
I know. I understand that. So when you say you were performing like at an early age, did you have like a stage mom or did you come
from? I didn't have a stage mom and I didn't come from a family of performers. No. But it happened that my mother went to school with a gentleman who started a children's youth group. It's much like a Young Up With People based in Cleveland where I grew up. And so he eventually became my agent, and we traveled, the group traveled all over the world. We sang for presidents and dignitaries, and it was an incredible
upbringing.
At what
age were you, like, performing in front of presidents and dignitaries?
At 8 for Nixon, I guess. I'd rather not do that
Nixon?
Math. But
wow.
Yeah, Nixon, Ford, Carter, all
kinds
of people.
Exciting. That must have been really...
Nicolae Ceaușescu of Romania before we decided he was the bad guy. I mean, it was, you know, all kinds of things happened back then.
Right. Of course. Of course. So did you have any mentors along the way?
I did. You know, I have a number of mentors in different ways. I think some of the most important ones for me, having grown up in the 70s and 80s, were the women who I eventually worked with, who were... female directors and producers who sort of took me under their wing. And I got to see, because back then I would be on a film set or a television set, and the only women on the set would usually be either hair and makeup or costume designers, and all the rest were men. So these couple of women took me under their wing and really showed me what it took to stay strong even when the odds were kind of against you back then.
Wow, that's amazing. It reminds me, I had an architect on recently, and she was the first, when she applied to school, to college, you know, for architecture, that said that, they said, we probably won't accept you because normally it's just men. And she,
right.
And she didn't go to that college, but she went to another one, and it's, you know, you have to be strong, I guess.
Yep. And yeah. it really pays off in the end, because a lot of times, you know, these jobs, even no matter if it's entertainment, theater, no matter what it is, you're going to have things thrown at you that you have to respond to, and you have to remain respectable, and it's it can be tough.
Right. So they were good. They were good guiders, and
absolutely.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, what does an executive director mean? I mean, what are some of your responses?
I love that question because it's anything,
anything
from
and everything.
Exactly. You know, I laugh because in one minute I could be having lunch with a major donor and soliciting a new board member. And the next minute, you know, I get a text that says, oh, no one showed up to tend the bar in the theater. And by the way, the John's overflowing and, you know, can you come help? So it really is sort of an all-encompassing job. But in general, I oversee the big picture. What between our artistic director and I, who are great partners, Scott Schwartz, we look at what is it that our artists and our audience want to do and see, and what is it that's going to entertain but make people think. And so we try and bring all these aspects together under one roof for various audiences, from kids to, you know, older audiences to winter and local audiences to summer folks who are traveling versus people that are weekenders all year. It's such a wide variety out here. And
that must be difficult, though. I mean, it must be challenging.
It's always challenging. I think any nonprofit would tell you, let alone one that's in the arts. It's always challenging, but that's also part of the fun because, you know, quite frankly, you know, everyone says to me, well, oh, that show was fabulous. Just do that again. Well, if it was that easy and if we'd known that was going to be such a hit, of course we'd do that all
the
time.
We'd do 10 of them.
Exactly. But, you know, like Broadway, you never know what's going to hit.
That's interesting. quick question is the Sag Harbor Cinema, you know, has the rebuilding of that had any effect on Bay Street Theater in the way of donations, et cetera?
Well, I would just say that, first of all, I was there during the fire. I stood out there with all of my staff from 7 o'clock in the morning on and watched as our, you know, as the cinema burned down, which was a horrible thing. And other buildings as well caught fire. And there were points during that morning, which I will never forget, where I thought, you know, this entire town could go quickly.
Oh, it seemed that way.
It was a nightmare.
Wow.
And so that being said, of course, I want the cinema back. And I'm glad that this group of people were able to do that. Has it affected us? I would say that it's affected us in the fact that when people are giving and donating, they can be confused easily. Mm. So people refer to the theater. Well, we're the theater, they're a theater, but they're really a cinema. But so from a fundraising perspective and the fact that it is a small pool from which we all draw here on the East End, you know, in that sense, it's been a little difficult, right. Because it has taken a lot of money to, you know, for them to buy the property and, of course, begin a campaign to build it. So, but that's going to happen for all of us out here in some way, shape, or form. You know, we're all going to have capital campaigns or whatever it might be at different times. And we all sort of have to learn to manage that and work together.
Right, exactly. So one of the shows that is coming up shortly is Evita.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, how's that? Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I can tell you that the the band has just arrived, and they're busy rehearsing for that. And the cast and crew are coming out as we speak. So by the time you air this, hopefully it'll be thriving and
sure
selling out. So it runs the entire month, and it's an entire Latinx cast. All the adult members of the cast are all what we call Latinx.
Wow, that is fascinating.
And we're very proud of being able to do that.
You know, I want to have you come back again because we're running out of time, because I think, just to elaborate on that, especially when it comes to actors' equity, a lot of people don't realize the theater is an actors' equity
yes.
theater,
yes.
which has certain limitations and benefits, I assume. And
yep.
We're going to have you back. Tracy Mitchell, it's been a delight having you on the program for Bay Street Theater. How can someone reach out and donate or support Bay Street Theater?
You can support in whatever way works for you. If you want to actually donate, you can give us a shout at 631-725-0818 and speak to myself or Kim Fink, our Director of Development. You can call our box office to buy tickets at 631-725-9500 or go online at baystreet.org.
Fantastic. This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back with my next guest, boat surveyor Ed Viola.
This is 88.3 FM WPPB Southampton, Peconic Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and today I have with me Ed Viola, who is a boat surveyor. Hi, Ed. How are you today?
I'm doing well, John.
I'm glad you're back again.
All righty. Thanks.
Yeah. What is a boat surveyor?
Well, we're an independent sort, working in conjunction with certain standards that are set forth by the Coast Guard and the American Boat and Yacht Council. And what we do is basically inspect boats to make sure that they are up to certain standards, whether we're representing an owner, a buyer, insurance company, finance company.
Where do you come into practice? Because I didn't know that you even existed until I was talking with Lisa from Ship to Shore. And she said, oh, got to call Ed. He's the best guy out there. And, oh, by the way, Lisa just recently had her birthday.
Ah.
So let's give a shout out to her and happy birthday, Lisa.
All right. Happy birthday, Lisa.
Do you want to say happy birthday? No, we'll say that for another time when we see her. And anyway, I was just thinking, one of the things that I saw recently is that ethanol used in marinas when you go to pull up your boat, the gas, is there less ethanol as compared to, say, the gas that we use for
an auto?
No, I think there's a federal regulation in terms of how much ethanol could be used, although that amount seems to vary. The problem with it is it creates a fuel and water separation, and probably the most important thing is when a boat is not used, that fuel sits in the tank, separates, and then you have a problem. You know, especially with some of these new high-tech engines, it just wreaks havoc with the internal parts.
When you say the internal parts, you mean like the engine itself or just the well, they don't even have
carburetors. Well, eventually the engine itself, but usually it would start in the whole, you know, fuel system, the injectors, carburetors, and so on.
And they clog it up?
Yeah, they corrode internal. You know, again, these electronic engines are so fine and precise that, you know, any kind of a mix creates a problem.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting that now the engines that they make are so they're computer generated, aren't
right.
they? Yeah.
Well, the thing is, in a car, we burn fuel probably too much. You know, you're filling up your tank, you know, every week or so. In a boat, sometimes the fuel sit in there for months. And again, that's where the problem lies.
All right. Now, if somebody's going for you've done yachts. I mean, what's entailed in doing a yacht to do an inspection on a yacht?
Well, what's the definition of a yacht? You know,
yeah, that's a very good
you
question.
Know, they say it's a boat, but it has wine, women, and champagne. You know, you know, the yachts, we go through the same procedures, you know, whether a boat's 120 feet or, you know, 20 feet, they have a pointy end, a flat end, you know, there's a fuel system, there's electrics, there's a motor. So you have to go through all the aspects and, again, make sure they're up to certain standards.
Now, on the yacht, do you have to get inside to look at the hull? I mean, the
structure?
Yeah, the structure.
Yeah, that's very important. Obviously, you know, you could have two good engines and all the components are good, but if you're in a unsound hull, what good is it?
Hmm. What happens in a case like that? Can that be remedied?
Well, it depends on what the problem is. You know, some things are caused by damage, you know, submersions, hitting a rock. Some deficiencies are inherent in a boat right from the day it was built.
Hmm. And do you recommend getting an inspection on a brand new boat?
Well, it's a little bit of a loaded question. You know, I make my living being a surveyor, so.
Yeah, but I mean,
you know, it depends. It depends on the manufacturer. There are some manufacturers that pretty much put out a flawless product. But, you know, what I tell people, sometimes it's nice to do a new boat because there could be problems or changes that may be needed, and it's easier to have them done before purchase than afterwards.
Right. That makes sense. Would you have any advice to give to somebody that's thinking about purchasing a boat?
Well, hire a surveyor. I mean, take your time. I think what happens with people buying boats, you know, you get love is blind, so to speak, you know, and you don't see problems right in front of you. So it's sometimes better, whether it is a surveyor or a friend that, you know, has some familiarity with boats, you know, to come along and, you know, take a look. You can look through, you know, some of the cloudiness that a buyer might have.
Right, right. Now, on the other side of the coin, is there any advice that you would give to a seller?
Don't hire a surveyor. No.
No, I would think just the opposite.
To find any problems is, before. For a seller that owns a boat that's going to survey, the thing is to pretty much prepare it. You know, don't leave the lockers full of gear, you know, because then it makes it difficult for us to really do our job.
So, you know what? It almost sounds like it's so similar to selling a home, because one of the pieces of advice that I always give is, you know, declutter
right.
your home. So what you're saying is declutter the boat.
Well, then, you know, if I have to spend time, you know, emptying lockers or moving things around, it gives me less time, you know, to do what I'm hired to do.
Right, right, right. So you have a checklist that you follow? I mean,
I alluded to it earlier. This is, you know, a list that I've developed over a period of time. And I always say at the end of the day, I look through all my paperwork, and if my pages are all filled up, I've done my job.
Right. Now, when you started and you deal mainly on the East End, how many guys were out there?
Well, I started about 30 years ago, and there was really just, I think, maybe two or three guys on all of Long Island. So I was lucky enough to get into the profession at that time and have since gotten myself pretty established. Now I bet there's 25 guys all over Long Island.
Wow.
You know, so
wow.
You got now, a lot to choose from.
So let's see. Do you have a website by any chance? That
I did. I don't at this point in time.
And why is that?
You know, I'm slowing down a little bit and trying to simplify my life. You know, looking forward to maybe move on and maybe get somebody along that I could teach and,
right.
You know, have
come into that.
To take over.
You could be like a mentor to them.
Well, in a way, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been at it for a while, so.
Is there any, have you ever found something that was surprising to you that when you look first glance at the boat looked like it was okay and then all of a sudden, yeah, it doesn't turn out to be and there's like a major thing that could really
well,
just.
You know, I've learned not to talk to a buyer until I'm finished, because there are times that that's exactly what happens. The boat looks good, everything's fine, and in the last few minutes, you know, something comes up. You know, you just 10 minutes ago told the person, hey, you got a great boat here, and 10 minutes later it's like, I have to call you back, you know, that whole side is delaminated, you know, and that has happened on a few occasions.
Right. Well, Ed, it's been a delight having you on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon and have a safe journey.
You've been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people about the places and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, associate broker with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.